Welcome. My name is Haley Titus Mitchell, and I'm a neuroscience PhD candidate in my final month of study at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, and as a member of the Ratner Lab at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. I am currently studying remyelination in the brain and testing preclinical therapeutics. Upon graduation, I will be joining the lab of Stephen Miller at Northwestern University School of Medicine to perform preclinical therapeutic trials on selective immune suppression and myelin repair in mouse models of MS. My personal and professional life goal is to cure MS, as my mother has secondary progressive MS. I'm honored to serve on the board of the Ohio Valley chapter of the National MS Society, and I'm happy to be with you here on today's national research call. Tonight, we will explore the current work being done on the Progressive MS Alliance Initiative and the Wellness Work Group. I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Bruce Bebo. He is the Executive Vice President of Research at the National MS Society, whose responsibilities include directing the Society's comprehensive research strategy. He joined the Society in 2012 as the Associate Vice President of Discovery Research, with a responsibility for the Society's biomedical research grant and fellowship training programs. In addition, he serves on the scientific leadership team of the Progressive MS Alliance. He brings over 25 years of experience in MS research. After receiving his PhD in immunology from Texas A&M University, he completed a National MS Society-sponsored postdoctoral fellowship at the Portland VA Medical Center, and then served on the research faculty at Oregon Health and State Health and Science University. He also brings experience from industry and nonprofit sectors, having served as the Director of Immunology Research for the pharmaceutical company Albion GmbH, and as the Director of Research and Medical Programs for the National Cirrhosis Foundation. During his tenure at the National Cirrhosis Foundation, he was instrumental in significantly increasing the foundation's investments in research. With that, I will now turn it over to Bruce.
Well, thank you, Haley. Thanks for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to be on the phone with everybody today. And I'm going to take about the next, I don't know, 30 to 40 minutes to, go over the latest in MS research and tell you about some of the key advances that I've been seeing over the last few years, and then a little bit about what the Society is doing to promote MS research and improve the lives of people living with MS. So we'll start off. I like to call the beginning of this MS 401. I think this is a time where many people would say, well, we're going to do MS 101, like freshman level MS introduction. But I know everyone on this call is beyond the 101 level. So we're going to do a little bit more in-depth overview of MS, and particularly what the challenges are and exist around finding solutions for people living with progressive forms of MS. And then we'll go over some key advances in research, and then again we'll review what the Society is doing to find solutions for people living with all forms of MS. So I hope you're following along with the presentation. And so what I'd like to review on this slide is MS 401 slide. And what I'm really trying to highlight on this slide are the differences between relapsing forms of MS and progressive forms of MS. So I think many of you know that primary progressive MS is a rare form, about 10% of all MS cases, and it's characterized by a steady, not necessarily rapid, but a steady increase in disability in the absence of attacks or relapses. And that secondary progressive MS, which is more common, and it's estimated that about half of people that are living with MS at any point in time are in the progressive phase of the disease. And this progressive phase is characterized by a steady progression of disability that follows a relapsing remitting course. That's the secondary progressive MS. And now, experts mostly agree that the main difference between the relapsing forms of MS and progressive forms is a shift from inflammation to demyelination, inflammation and demyelination that drives the disability, to a slow loss of nerve cells that results in shrinking of the brain and the spinal cord. And this is a process that's referred to as atrophy. And I have bad news for everybody on the call, myself included, and that is that all of our brains are shrinking. After you get to be about 25 or so, your brain starts shrinking instead of growing. And it happens that people living with MS, their brains are shrinking a little bit faster than people that aren't living with MS. And so the field believes this atrophy, this nerve is caused by a neurodegenerative process, and that this neurodegeneration might have parallels with other conditions that are characterized by neurodegeneration, like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, what we know is that progression occurs at different rates, and some people it occurs more rapidly and some more slowly, and that the rate of progression is unpredictable. Another clue that we're learning is that none or of the disease-modifying treatments that have worked for relapsing remitting MS that have been tested in progressive MS have really worked very well. And while this has been obviously very disappointing for people living with progressive forms of MS, it does provide a really important clue about this fundamental difference between relapsing and progressive MS. So moving on to the next slide, and just overview on this slide, you know, why aren't there more treatments or any treatments really for progressive MS? And, you know, the short answer is we don't really understand the cause or the pathways that lead to progressive MS. But I think you all know you wouldn't just get the short answer from me. It's more complicated than that. There are a number of roadblocks that are keeping us from developing treatments for progressive forms of disease. And one of those is there's a lack of animal models for progressive disease in contrast to relapsing remitting disease. And this is a critical gap or critical opportunity we have need to fill in order to make advances for progressive disease. It's interesting. Progression is not really well defined. It's really hard to measure. It's hard, and many of you maybe have experienced this. It's hard for a physician to determine exactly when the progressive phase of the disease has begun. And another roadblock is a lack of accepted endpoints in clinical trials. So, again, in contrast to relapsing remitting disease, where there is a well-accepted outcome measure, and this outcome measure, many of you may know, are these enhancing or gadolinium-enhancing MRI lesions. It's really the gold standard for an endpoint for the early phase clinical trials for relapsing forms of MS. We don't have that gold standard for progressive forms of MS, and that's a area of opportunity, an area that of interest and research that's ongoing. And then, as I mentioned before, the lack of effectiveness of disease-modifying treatments in relapsing remitting MS is a clue. And again, it suggests that while anti-inflammatory medications and immunosuppressive or immunoregulatory drugs can have profound effects for people living with relapsing forms of MS, they don't work in progressive forms, and it suggests that inflammation and autoimmunity and immune mechanisms are less important in the progressive phase. Now, I said all these kind of downer things, but there is really reasons to be optimistic, and I'll mention them some more on the following slides. But one of the big reasons is that there are a number of ongoing interventional, which means testing and actual treatment, a number of ongoing interventional trials in progressive forms of MS, and I'm quite optimistic that something's going to come out of these clinical trials soon. So let's move on to the next slide. So let's talk a little bit about neurodegeneration and what the mechanisms for neurodegeneration might be in MS and how that knowledge is going to help, I believe, lead us to treatments that will help people living with all forms of MS. So one of the mechanisms that's believed to drive progression is this dysfunction in the ability to repair myelin, and I'm going to talk about that in the next slide in a little more detail. But as time goes on in MS, the ability of our nervous systems to repair the damage is lost. And it leaves the nerve projections, the axons, the nerve fibers, and the nerve cells themselves vulnerable to degeneration. And so if we can figure out a way to promote myelin repair, I think we're going to go a long way towards preventing this neurodegeneration that we think is driving progressive MS. And then the second mechanism that's being explored is it's other ways to promote neuroprotection. So there's a lot of ideas about what's causing the damage to the actual nerve tissue, to the neurons and their nerve fibers. There's sort of an abundance of excitatory neurotransmitters, it seems to be one mechanism, oxidative stress, a loss of, again, with the loss of the myelin sheath and the glial cells that make it, the lack of factors that those cells make to support the survival of neurons and nerve fibers is another mechanism. And then just the last hypothesis is sort of energy failure. So this requiring a nerve cell to work so hard to try to keep up and try to keep producing electrical impulses and work in spite of all this damage as another mechanism that's being explored as driving this neurodegeneration in MS. And so we're going to talk a little bit in more detail about some of that in the next few slides. So let's move on. So here's another reason to be really optimistic. I mean, there are cells in our brains and our nervous system that have the ability to repair myelin. And I want you to remember these cells. They're called oligodendrocyte precursor cells. Easier probably to just say OPC. They're almost 10% of all the cells in your nervous system. And on this slide, they're those red cells with like a bright yellow middle. And these cells have a tremendous ability to induce what I like to call natural repair. So this is repair that's accomplished by your own nervous system during and after an immune attack on your myelin sheath. So let's go to the next slide, and I'm going to run through kind of an illustration of what's happening in the nervous system and where opportunities are for promoting repair. So this is sort of an illustration, a cartoon of what the normal white matter looks like. It doesn't look very white, does it? It's it's green and red and black. But that circle in the middle is supposed to be a blood capillary in the nervous system. And those red dots are nerve axons. Those are nerve fibers. And the green around those red dots are the myelin sheaths. And you can, they're like insulation on an electric cord, allowing the efficient electrical conduction through those nerve fibers and normal nervous system function. And then if we advance to the next slide, the first stages of relapsing forms of MS is this influx of inflammatory cells. These are white blood cells that are activated and are, for reasons we still don't completely understand, recognizing the myelin sheath as something that's dangerous. And these white blood cells migrate through that blood capillary, and they get access to the nervous system, and they go in and they start to destroy myelin. And if we go to the next slide, once the inflammation resolves, there is some demyelination, but that demyelination gets repaired by those oligodendrocyte precursor cells. Let's go to the next slide. But over time, what happens is that you're able to repair, and those oligodendrocyte precursor cells come in and they repair the myelin, and then maybe you have another attack of inflammation, and you're able to repair it after that. But as time goes on, the ability of those oligodendrocyte precursor cells to repair the myelin is lost, and the scar is formed in that area. And let's go to the next slide. But what's hopeful here is that despite this lack of ability to repair as time goes on during MS, those oligodendrocyte precursor cells are still there. They're still viable. They're alive. They still migrate to areas of damage, but again, for reasons we don't really completely understand, they lose the ability to repair the myelin. So if we can figure out how to promote or return those oligodendrocyte precursor cells as OPCs back to a state of repairing the myelin, then we've got something. We've got an answer for promoting repair. And we're learning more every day about the factors that are promoting natural repair and factors that inhibit natural repair. And I'm going to talk about a few in the next few slides. So one of the factors that we know that inhibits myelin repair has got this really interesting name called LINGO. And LINGO is produced by nervous system cells, and it is a factor that inhibits remyelination. It inhibits the ability of those oligodendrocyte precursor cells from repairing and making new myelin. And so what scientists have developed is an agent that's anti-LINGO. So this is a little bit like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is a biologic medication or drug that binds to LINGO and gets rid of it and neutralizes it. And in this figure, what I'm showing you are electron micrographs from a study in an animal model that looks like MS. And on the left hand of the figure, let's look at the bottom left part of that figure, and you'll see a whole bunch of stars there, and those are nerve fibers. Those are nerve axons where the myelin has been stripped off and has not been repaired. And then if you look at the right side in the bottom of that figure, you'll see a bunch of those stars again. And again, those are nerve axons. But now you see this dark circle around those nerve axons, and that's myelin. And that's myelin that's been repaired, and those are mice that were treated with this anti-LINGO. So this, at least in mice, anti-LINGO seems to promote repair. Now, maybe some of you heard a news story. It was late last week. Biogen is developing this anti-LINGO, and they've shown some months ago that it was safe to treat humans with this anti-LINGO, and just reported literally like about a week ago that they have a signal in the optic nerve of people that have optic neuritis, which is oftentimes a sort of early symptom of MS, that they were able to demonstrate a signal that repair is happening in the participants in that trial that were taking anti-LINGO. So just the first hint now of an agent that can promote repair. Now, I don't know if LINGO is going to make it. It may, and it may not. But this is a milestone. This is on our march towards finding agents that can promote repair and prevent neurodegeneration. The sponsors, Biogen, are performing a clinical trial in relapsing remitting MS that's expected to report out next year. So I'm optimistic, and I'm anxious to hear the results of the trial in relapsing remitting MS. So let's move on to the next slide. So another really interesting approach I wanted to share with you is the repurposing of a drug that's called benztropine. Now this was a really cool study by an investigator at UCSF, and maybe many of you have heard of Jonah Chan by now. He's won the Barancic Prize last year for innovation in MS research, and has developed a high-throughput assay in the laboratory for testing new repair compounds. And so he can test thousands of drugs at a time for their ability to promote repair in a tissue culture dish, in a lab dish in his laboratory. And he spent a few years developing this really, really interesting, innovative assay that's now paying off. And this is work that was, sponsored and supported by all of you through the MS Society. And he screened a library of drugs that are already approved by the FDA and for other indications. So the advantage of that is that if he finds a hit, that's a drug that could go to a clinical trial really quickly. So he did this high-throughput screening, and he identified a drug called benztropine that was very potently induced or promoted repair in a tissue culture dish in a laboratory environment, and then tested the ability of this agent to promote myelin repair in an animal model, just like the slide we saw earlier. And again, let's focus on the bottom left panel, the far left, and then the one next to it. And these are animals that were where this MS-like disease was induced. And you can see a lot of circles in the bottom of that, in that bottom left-hand figure, that are empty. They have no dark circles around them, and they've been demyelinated and are bare and are vulnerable to neurodegeneration. And if you look at the right side of that figure, again, just like the last electron micrograph we saw, you see a lot of more of dark circles around those nerve fibers. And those are animals that where this MS-like disease was induced, but they were given this drug benztropine that promoted natural repair. And then just on the right side of this slide are two figures, just using a different way. This is using labeling the OPCs, these cells that can promote repair, fluorescently, and then looking at animals that had this experimental model of MS either treated with a control or treated with the benztropine. And I hope you can see in your computer monitors a lot more little green dots on the bottom part of that figure in animals that were treated with this drug versus the ones up on top that were treated with the control. And so this is really solid evidence that this drug and related drugs can promote repair, at least in animals. And so remember I said that this agent was already FDA approved for another indication. And because Jonah works at UCSF and they have both basic research scientists and a very well, highly regarded clinical research and clinical care center, Jonah and collaborated with a number of neurologists there to get this into the clinic months after this finding. And they are recruiting patients, and study might even be fully enrolled at this point, enrolling people, and they'll be testing the ability of these repair-promoting drugs, again, in an optic neuritis model, which is, it's an easier model to measure, we think, to measure repair, and we're all very anxious to see the results of this trial, and very encouraging. And there are a number of other trials looking at promoting natural repair that we don't have time to talk about. But let's move on to the next slide. I want to talk about another strategy that we're very encouraged by that could promote repair, and this is transplantation of OPC. So rather than natural repair, this is the idea behind this is to actually transplant and cells at these OPCs that can promote repair. And this is being done. It's really cool. What they're doing is they're taking cells from your skin. And don't ask me why in this figure that I stole off the internet that they're showing or demonstrating these cells coming from your face. I don't think they'd take them from your face. But they're removing those skin cells, and they're able to turn those cells back into very primitive stem cells, and they call these iPS cells, which stands for induced pluripotent stem cells. It doesn't matter, but they're very primitive cells. And then they're able to turn those cells back into whatever cells they're interested in working with. And in the case of MS, they're interested in turning them into oligodendrocyte precursor cells. So there are laboratories now that have performed this in culture strategy of accumulating oligodendrocyte precursor cells and then transplanting them, in this case, into mice. So the figures on the right of the slide we're looking at are the results of transplanting human oligodendrocyte precursor cells derived from the skin into a special mouse that's called a shiverer mouse because this mouse is genetically deficient in myelin. And these human cells, and those are colored red in that red and green image, those human cells are able to find those naked nerve fibers and those naked axons, and they're able to produce beautiful myelin sheaths. So all that green is human myelin in a mouse deficient in myelin. And that electron micrograph at the bottom of that is beautiful myelin. It's thick. It's compacted, and it is undoubtedly functional B beautiful myelin being produced by human OPCs derived from the skin. Now, we're a little bit far away from being able to do this kind of transplantation study in humans, and there's some challenges, technical and safety challenges, that we're going to have to just be clear about before we can transplant these into humans. But this field is just accelerating and advancing at a rate that is hard to predict where we're going to be a few years from now with this. So I find this very, very encouraging. So now I'd like to shift to the other strategy that I mentioned, this idea of neuroprotection. And a lot of what we're trying in MS for neuroprotection, we're learning from other neurodegenerative diseases. Again, as I mentioned, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, some of the processes that are driving neurodegeneration that is responsible for this atrophy, this shrinking of the brain that we see in people with MS, could be slowed or stopped by promoting neuroprotection. And there are a number and a number of strategies and no shortage of ideas about how we could promote neuroprotection. And I'm going to talk about a couple of them in the next couple slides. So let's shift to the next slide, hopefully. There we go. So I want to talk about a study of simvastatin. And this is a drug known as Zocor. Many of you might be familiar with the statins. This is one of many different kinds of statins that are prescribed and are used for lowering blood cholesterol. There was a gentleman, a very well-known clinical scientist, Jeremy Chadwick at the University of London, who tried a high dose of this particular statin, Zocor, or simvastatin. This 80-milligram dose is the highest dose that's on the label for cholesterol lowering. It's a high dose in people that were living with secondary progressive MS, 140 people. It's a good-sized trial. And he followed them for 2 years. And we're looking at two outcome measures. Remember, we don't have a validated or accepted outcome measure, but this trial really helped us think a little bit more about outcome measures. And what Dr. Chadaway showed was that there was a decrease in the rate at which the brain was shrinking in people in the treatment arm of this trial compared to people in the control or the placebo arm of the trial. He found a 50% decrease in the rate of this brain atrophy in people taking the active simvastatin versus the control. And that's a very dramatic and perhaps surprising finding. And accompanying that decrease in atrophy, what Dr. Chadaway also found was that there was a improvement in disability, a decrease in EDS. Some of you may be familiar with the EDSS score. But there was a change in EDSS score, a change in disability that suggested not only were we seeing changes in imaging looking at brain atrophy, but also in disability. And that's the first time anybody really had demonstrated any change in disability in people living with progressive MS. So we were very encouraged by this result. I'm not sure what the future of statins are going to be for progressive MS, but it's yielded information around a pathway that we could maybe manipulate in other ways, and it certainly will be a milestone that we'll look back on when we have better treatments or perhaps even a cure one day for progressive forms of MS as one of the first studies that really made headway in progressive MS. And I want to talk about a couple of other studies that are ongoing. I mentioned there were close to 60 clinical trials right now in testing different strategies for progressive MS. A couple I want to highlight. One's called the SPRINT MS trial, and this is taking place here in the United States. A dozen or more centers. It's the principal investigator is based at the Cleveland Clinic, and they're looking at a neuroprotective agent called ibutilast. And this is a two-year study with the outcome measure being brain shrinkage or the rate of brain shrinkage or brain atrophy. And then they're also, and this is really important, they're also going to look at some more experimental imaging outcomes that might be alternative outcome measures for future clinical trials. So it's testing one of the leading agents for neuroprotection and also perhaps outcome measures that could be used for future trials. And then the other clinical trial I want to mention is called MS-SMART. These all have really nifty names. This one's based in the United Kingdom, and it's testing three different agents. And what's really neat about this trial is that this is a new trial design where they're testing multiple different potentially neuroprotective agents in one trial. And this is going to save time because they won't need to recruit as many patients as you would need to recruit if you were testing these all individually. It's going to save money because you only need to compare these to one placebo group. So it's going to be a faster trial. It's going to be cheaper. And I'm very curious and anxious to hear the outcomes from this clinical trial. Again, it's looking at the rate of brain shrinkage or brain atrophy at 2 years. And they'll also be looking at some of these advanced imaging and also looking at spinal fluid biomarkers as maybe another way of measuring outcomes for trials in progressive MS. So, all right, okay, so let's go on to the next slide. I want to just change gears a little bit, and we'll stop geeking out so much. And I want to tell you a little bit about what the society is doing to try to find a better solutions for people living with all forms of MS. And I want to assure you that this is our highest priority and that the way to get there is by research, and that the society's invested a lot of money in MS research over the years. And I don't think anyone would argue that this investment has accelerated the development of most, if not all, of the disease-modifying treatments that we have now for relapsing forms of MS, disease-modifying treatments that have significantly improved the quality of life of people, particularly living with relapsing remitting forms of MS. Our investment last year, in our last business year, was about $50 million, and that's going to support 380 projects that in a comprehensive portfolio, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next couple of slides. And this business year, we are investing, I can tell you, closer to $53 million. And we are, the National MS Society is far and away the leader, the global leader in funding outside of the federal government in funding research and making a difference in the lives of people living with MS. So I want to just go over a little bit some of the principles that govern and guide our research investments. You know, we intend to be comprehensive and collaborative. We used to use this phrase, you know, we'll leave no stone unturned, which I really like. And now we use a term, no opportunity wasted. They both mean the same thing. We're going to pursue every promising path that has a promise for people living with MS. And we act with an incredible sense of urgency to find solutions as fast as possible. Our investments are strategic. We're looking for gaps and opportunities that are really going to catalyze advances. We leverage our investments by working with other agencies, including the National Institutes of Health and other MS societies and other agencies that have common goals to try to catalyze and accelerate development of knowledge and new treatments for MS. We work through a centralized peer review system. We perform a tremendous amount of rigorous due diligence on all of the research opportunities that we're presented with during the course of the year. And I would add to this that in addition to all the due diligence that we do to be sure we're funding the most promising research, that we also, our oversight doesn't end after we select the research, that the society has a team of scientists and administrators that monitor the progress, both research-wise and financially, of all the grants in our portfolio to be sure that our funded investigators are making satisfactory progress. And another thing that sets us apart, I think, from many others, is that we don't have any boundaries. I mean, we don't care where the next development in MS research is, where the cure is going to come from, or where the next treatment is going to come from. It doesn't matter. So we will fund research around the world. I'll say about 10% of our research portfolio are being performed by researchers that are outside of the United States, and that's something that's unique to the MS Society, the National MS Society. So if we move to the next slide, I want to tell you about an initiative that the National MS Society is leading to promote research in progressive MS around the world. And this is called the International Progressive MS Alliance. It's an expanding alliance of MS organizations that are around the world. And the mission of this movement is to expedite the development of therapies for effective disease modification and also symptom management in progressive MS. So we've been funding a lot of research in progressive MS for many years, and we're still struggling to develop to find effective treatments. And so we had to do something different. We had to do something to accelerate and catalyze the world on this important problem. And so this is the sort of inspiration, I guess, for the Progressive MS Alliance. And let's go to the next slide. So some of the key priorities for the alliance included leveraging and coordinating the global MS movement to focus on progressive MS. And this now includes a commitment, a global commitment, and I'll share with you the MS Society's participating here in a minute, of an additional 22 million euros. So we're working around with MS societies around the world. So our currency in this movement is euros, but that's the equivalent of about $30 million over the next 6 years. And this is the first time ever that the MS societies outside the United States are funding research together without thinking about geography, with running with the same philosophy that we have, that we don't care where the next development is going to be. We're going to fund the best research no matter where it is. And that's the key priority of this movement, is funding the best science anywhere in the world no matter where it is. So let's move to the next slide and finish up on the Progressive Alliance. So to give you a little bit more information, there are six managing members. These are the six major MS societies around the world. Every MS society that has the capacity to invest and participate at the level required to be a managing member is on board on this movement. And that includes ourselves, the MS Society from Australia, Italy, the United Kingdom, and Canada, and the MS International Federation, which is a umbrella organization that promotes MS research around the world that was actually started by the founder of our MS Society, Sylvia Lowry, many years ago. And then there are a number of contributing members that are contributing financially and intellectually, but at a lower level than the managing members. And those include the MS societies in Denmark, Spain, Germany, the Netherlands, and France. And this alliance is growing. And so let's go to the next slide. So I just want to review a couple of key milestones, because this is, it's a new movement. We're entering our second year. And what have we done so far? So the alliance has convened a global scientific leader. So we got all the thought leaders from around the world together, and we convened a meeting to develop a research strategy. We have the best minds in the entire planet in one room in Milan, Italy, about 18 months ago to come up with, identify where the gaps and opportunities are, and develop a strategy. And out of that strategy came a funding mechanism to award pilot grants to try to catalyze and spur activity in progressive MS research around the world. And we awarded 22 pilot research grants a couple of months ago from researchers in 11 different countries. And just in the last month or so, we issued a new request for grant proposals that are focused on establishing global collaborative networks. So these are going to be networks of scientists around the world working together on important unanswered questions in progressive MS. And I think of this a little bit like a Manhattan Project or like a Apollo Project. I mean, this is big stuff, and because it's a big problem, and it needs a different approach and a unique and promising approach. So I did want to mention the work that we're doing with the Progressive Alliance, and hopefully that inspires you a little bit. And then let's click onto the next slide. And before I jump into how to keep up on MS research, I did also want to mention and neglected to put a slide in on this topic, the society's I guess reasonably new emphasis and interest and promoting research in wellness and lifestyle. So we the scientific community is coming around and realizing that people are trying different ways of addressing or improving their quality of life by changing their diet, taking different supplements, exercise and rehabilitation, and these things are working for people individually. But we don't really have a good good data to support any specific wellness or lifestyle approach. And it's problematic because it's hard to make recommendations for. I'm sure many of you have looked on the internet and seen all the diets and the exercises and the supplements, and we don't really know for sure which one of those or which of those are going to help people with MS, and there is a real lack of research in that area. And the society realized this a few years ago and has launched an initiative, a wellness and lifestyle initiative, to try to get more information to help people make smart decisions about lifestyle and wellness changes. So this is a similar approach to the International Alliance, where we recruited and convened many of the thought leaders that work in this area of lifestyle and wellness, and they all met last November in a sort of satellite meeting to our National Volunteer Leadership Conference. And they met for 2 days. We got all the smart people in the room for 2 days focusing on this question, and with the purpose of developing a strategy for supporting research that will ultimately give us the information that we need to help advise people how to make the best decisions to live their best lives. So I did want to make sure that you all were aware of our wellness and lifestyle initiatives. And before I want to leave plenty of time for questions, I just want to let you know, how you can keep up on MS research. So these calls are terrific, and there are a lot of platforms and ways to get information. I want to encourage you to subscribe to the monthly e-newsletter that's focused on research. I would encourage you to visit our website. We have a strong team that helps to translate what's happening in the research world for everyday people. And we have a lot of terrific information on the website and are very active in keeping up on new news from clinical trials and breakthroughs and so forth on our website. And so I want to encourage you to go there if you have more questions about research. And then go to the last slide. And I know that Doris is going to give us the instructions for how you can ask questions in this last 15 minutes or so.
Wonderful. Thanks, Bruce. Okay, everyone, there are two different ways to ask questions. For those of you using the chat feature, I've been tracking all your questions, and we'll work them in to our Q&A. The operator is also ready to assist those of you on the phone with your questions. To ask a question via phone, please press 1-4 on your telephone, and that will prompt the operator, and they will assist you with your questions. While the operator queues up the questions on the phone, we're going to go ahead and start with a couple of the questions from the chat feature. So, Bruce, because you just finished talking about some of our work with the Wellness Initiative, there have been a couple of questions on the chat about whether we're going to be funding any research into diet, and specifically Terry Wall's diet protocol.
So thanks for the question. And diet was certainly one of the topics that was a focus of discussion at this strategy meeting, which included actually Dr. Terry Walls as one of the experts in the room during this two-day meeting. Diet was emphasized, exercise was emphasized, and things, lifestyle changes that could help with mood was another topic that was covered during the session. So the strategy that is being formed by this task force, again, that includes Dr. Walls and many others, is still being discussed and still being formed. So I can't say for sure what the strategies or what kind of research is going to be promoted out of that. I would be surprised if diet was not one of the priorities, study areas that come out of that. But it'd be premature for me to say, because I don't know what the outcomes are going to be. I will say that the society is supporting research currently in our portfolio focused on diets and focused on rehabilitation and exercise and lifestyle changes that that are outside of this strategy that's being developed. And we are learning more every day about how diet and exercise can improve the quality of lives of people living with MS.
Okay, great, thank you. Another question from the chat feature: how close are we to getting a drug to repair myelin damage?
Well, I'm kind of a betting man, I guess, and I think we're close. I mean, I hope you can sense the excitement and enthusiasm I have about that, promoting natural repair. I mean, I'm aware of now 3 clinical trials testing agents. These are early trials. These are sort of what we'd call either safety or really early clinical trials testing repair agents. But I think that, we'll see some agent, some strategy that promotes natural repair, in the next few years. So that's my prediction, and I might be willing to bet my mortgage on it.
Okay. Colin, do you have any questions from the phone lines queued up yet?
We do have a number of questions on the phones, first of which comes from the line of Sue Ellen. Your line is open. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. My question is, what do you think about the recent hypothesis that was publicized about MS being a metabolic disorder?
So thanks for the question, and I think there's evidence to suggest. I'm not sure that I would say that MS is a metabolic disorder, but I do think there are aspects or clues that metabolism might contribute to the risk for MS, primarily from studies that are connecting childhood obesity to MS. And there's a growing evidence that childhood obesity and having a high body mass index prior, in early development can increase a person's risk for MS. And there's some biological plausibility to that observation, in that there are hormones that are produced by fat cells, and that one of those hormones is called leptin. And it looks like leptin can regulate immune responses. And that this increase in body mass, this increase in fat, leads to increase in leptin and a promotion or an exacerbation or acceleration of immune responses that might lead to a higher risk for autoimmune diseases like MS. So there's a beginning of new knowledge that suggests there's a biological plausibility to that connection between higher body mass and MS that needs further exploration. But there is a growing appreciation that there might be a connection, but I wouldn't turn that into saying that MS is a metabolic disease or is caused by issues related to metabolism. It may contribute to a person's risk, and it may be part of a number of environmental factors or triggers that would change a person's risk, including low vitamin D, including exposure to Epstein-Barr. Smoking now has been shown to increase a person's risk for developing MS. There may be other environmental triggers or factors that together contribute to an increased risk for developing MS.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Okay. Another question from the chat line. So, Bruce, you talked a little bit about the ZOCOR trial, and so this question is, I have secondary progressive MS. Any reason I shouldn't be taking the maximum allowed dose of ZOCOR now?
Yeah, so that's a fine question, and I think we don't know enough about we can't make a treatment recommendation for statins based on the outcome of that clinical trial. It was a phase two, sort of middle of the path of development, drug development, clinical trial, and we don't know what perhaps some of the long-term positive effects of statins would be in MS, or perhaps even negative effects of taking such a high dose of statins. And we really, before being able to make a recommendation about taking statins for MS, would need to perform a clinical trial like that. I think that for the moment, statins would really only be prescribed for cholesterol lowering and not for MS.
Okay, Colin?
We have a question from the line of Noreen. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes. To normally check the effectiveness of a new therapy, they usually do that with an MRI. And let's say you are trying something off-label, like you talked about that new, possibility out there, benztropine. How long before, the effectiveness should be checked? And is it possible that an OCT would be okay checking on that?
So that's a great question, Noreen. Thanks for that. I think the timing between when you would take any experimental treatment that would promote repair, would kind of depend on the mechanism for how that agent promoted repair. And I don't think we know exactly the timing. So that I think you would have to measure your outcome at a lot of different time points to be sure that you were capturing any positive effects. I did mention that the clinical trials with, I think, all three of the repair agents are being tested in optic neuritis, and they are using this OCT that you referred to. Now, OCT stands for optical coherence tomography, and it's a non-invasive way. It uses light to image the thin layer of cells in the back of your eye called the retina, which is connected to the optic nerve, which is connected to your nervous system. And the idea is that that thickness of that optic nerve could be an indication of neurodegeneration that's happening, either in optic neuritis or maybe even in MS. And so it's a quick and painless, I even had it done at my ophthalmologist recently just for fun, a quick and painless way to that we think might be able to give us a signal about repair. But there's still some work that has to, it's not an accepted way of determining whether repair has happened, and there needs to be more work to validate OCT as a way to measure repair. But it is one of the leading ideas for how we could measure repair with these agents. And all of the trials I mentioned are using a number of measures because we don't know really exactly which one's going to work, but OCT is one of them for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question.
Okay, another question from the chat feature, and actually multiple people have asked this question. Can you comment on the studies being done in New York on intrathecal methotrexate?
Well, so I think that you're referring to the trial that Dr. Sadiq performed in New York a number of years ago and was published, it was several years ago, where the results looked promising. But I'm not aware of any further investigation of that approach, either by Dr. Sadiq or anyone else. So I'm not really sure. I'm not sure why it hasn't been followed up. The reported results were quite promising. And I don't know. I'm not privileged to any inside information around why it hasn't been pursued. No one else is testing it. And as far as I know, Dr. Sadiq's not formally testing intrathecal methotrexate. There are others that are testing intrathecal. And just for those that might not know what that means, that's injecting a drug directly into the spinal fluid, kind of like getting a spinal tap, only the other way around. You're putting stuff in instead of taking it out. There are investigators testing a drug, rituximab. Some of you remember rituximab. It's a biological medicine that inhibits a white blood cell called B cells. And there's a observation that in the connective tissue that covers your spinal cord and your brain, called the meninges, that you see these accumulations of these B cells, and that people think they may play a role in progressive MS. And you can't get to that. It's hard to get a biological medication into the nervous system without injecting it straight into there. So there are a couple of laboratories investigating intrathecal delivery of anti-B cell drugs, particularly rituximab, and I'm real interested to see how that comes out. But I don't know anybody who's formally testing intrathecal methotrexate right now.
Great. Colin, question from the phone line?
We do have a question from the line of Linda. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hello. I wondered when the drug Lemtrada and Savonex will be available in the United States. I know it's been approved. They've both been approved by FDA, but as yet, my doctor said they're not available by prescription yet. Do you know when they will be?
Thanks for that question. It's a fine question. I think the availability of Lemtrada will depend to a large degree on, a physician can prescribe Lemtrada now. It is available to prescribe. The
mm-hmm.
challenge in access is going to be the providers. And by providers, I mostly mean the insurers, whether that's private insurance or Medicare or Medicaid. And it's the access that is at this point in time, the limiting factor on its availability. And it will grow and it will get better. It always takes a while for these new drugs like Lemtrada to get traction and to get started. It's an infusion, and it requires really pretty special follow-up and special care. And there are, I think, limited places around the country right now that are prepared to treat with Lemtrada. So that's mm-hmm. another sort of barrier to access to that right now. But it's really at the beginning. It was just approved, a month or two ago. And it's the same with a lot of new agents. It takes a while for the machinery in our healthcare system to make that more broadly available. But Lemtrada will have a little bit extra challenge, again, because it is an infusion. And it does require really special monitoring and long-term follow-up that physicians and neurologists are going to need to be prepared to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the question.
Okay. And I show that it's 8 o'clock. I'm willing to go ahead and go through just a couple more questions, if everyone will just hang on the line for a minute. Bruce, we've got a question here on the chat feature regarding genetic mapping and if it's at the point where someone should do it and share the results with their children.
So, sorry, could you repeat that, Doris? The what feature?
The genetic mapping. Is it at a point
to where someone
should get it done and share the results with
Understood.
Family?
Okay, so the short answer, you've heard me, I give short answers and long answers. The short answer is no. We are learning more about the genetics of MS every day. The number of risk variants in our genetics and our genomes that have been identified is approaching 200. But none of them, or there isn't a pattern yet that's emerging that gives us enough information that's really actionable. None of them on their own, and no pattern has evolved that would really increase or give us more knowledge about a person's risk than we already know about a heritability and environmental exposures and things. So it's not really giving us anything extra yet from the ability to prognosticate or to predict risk for developing MS. At this point in time, it's not useful for that purpose. I suspect we're going to get there eventually, but it's going to be more than just genetics. It's going to be getting that genetic profile. It's going to be taking family histories, exposures, and even maybe imaging or biochemical factors out of the blood. It's going to be a combination of a number of things that's going to help us prognosticate or predict who's going to develop MS. I don't think genetics is going to stand on its own in that regard, but I could be wrong, but I don't think it will, and it's certainly not right now.
Okay. Colin, a question from the phone?
We do have a question from the line of Keith. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
My question probably goes in the metabolic aspects of the disease. I personally have experienced that every night at 10 o'clock, when it's time to go to bed, I actually start feeling normal. So what in the world would cause that to happen?
Yeah, that's I'm a little bit of a loss to know. I don't really – it's hard for me to
– You and everybody
know
else?
Why. I don't know. Honestly, that's – I have not heard that before, so that's really interesting. And I don't know, have you heard other people mention that to you before? Or, I mean, I'm curious about that.
I really haven't asked anybody else about it. My neurologist, and my neurologist, well, did you take a nap? And, well, no, I didn't take a nap. It's time for me to go to bed. I'm actually
– Yeah.
– I'm feeling it's time to go to bed, not
sure.
My usual, fatigue from the MS. It's just time to go to bed. So, and it's miraculous. It's like I don't have any issues whatsoever.
Well, I wonder, it's really complete speculation. And I don't think, and everybody, I think, would agree on the phone that everybody's MS is different. And it all follows kind of a different course and is unique, and so it's hard to really know what's going on. I could speculate maybe it might have something to do with body temperature, and maybe you mentioned metabolism. Maybe there's maybe slight changes in body temperature during the course of the day where you might be a little lower body temperature right before bed, and that affects nerve conduction speed and might make you feel a little bit better. I mean, and that's completely speculating on that regard. But I like to speculate sometimes. But it's very hard to know. And I have not heard that from other people before. But I'm going to keep my ears open for that to hear and maybe ask when I'm out speaking if anybody else has that experience and follow up on that. It's a very interesting observation.
Well. I am special. What can I tell you?
We're all special in some way or other.
Right. One person mentioned circadian rhythm. Well,
yeah.
What? I don't know enough about circadian rhythm, and I was hoping that perhaps you might have, but obviously that's not something that's ever been brought up for you.
Well, so you circadian rhythm is interesting. So this is our brain's ability to regulate sort of day and night cycles in your body. It's interesting. If you were locked in a cave with no light, your natural circadian cycle would be, it's about 23 hours a day. And so you would lose an hour every day without any clues from light in your environment to re-track your circadian rhythm. And there are hormones produced by the brain, melatonin, that signals the rest of your body to perform certain functions that are normal during the day and others during the night. And so there's been some, and I don't recall specifically, some studies of melatonin and other hormones related to circadian rhythms in MS. I don't exactly recall. There certainly weren't any conclusive studies, and I don't recall what the hints were around melatonin, but it's something maybe you might explore a little bit. So melatonin's the hormone, is produced by the pineal gland, and it regulates your sort of day-night cycle. And it might be something you could I don't have at my fingertips right now, and I don't remember the research, but it might be something you could look up.
Okay. Well, the search goes on.
Yeah, search goes on. Thanks for the question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. All right, so that concludes our question and answer session. I do have a couple of quick survey questions for those of you who are online. So I'm going to bring up the first question, and if you will just click in your screen to answer the question. So are you a partner, family member, or person with MS? Please click in the screen and answer the question. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next question. Was the material presented relevant to you? Yes or no? Please click in the center of your screen to answer your question. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move to the next question. Were the speakers and the information they presented easy to understand? Yes or no? Please click your answer on your screen. Okay, next question. Did you learn something new from this presentation? Please click in the center of your screen to answer your question. And that concludes our presentation this evening. I want to thank Haley for joining us today and doing such a great introduction. And thank you, Bruce, for putting together such a fantastic presentation. A lot of great feedback in the chat feature. Please remember that the presentation will be available online on our website along with a recording of tonight's presentation. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.